second case, which is United States v. Gonzalez and others. Mr. Sullivan.
It pleases the court, I'm John L. Sullivan. I'm here, I'm the attorney for defendant, appellant Luis Gonzalez. Kent Anderson of the Federal Defender Program in Peoria joined in my arguments on behalf of his client, Miguel Ayala. Mr. Anderson is not here today. He has agreed to let me argue on behalf, these issues on behalf of the defendant's appellants. Judges, I would like to argue a little bit at the beginning by analogy, and it may be most of my argument. When my daughter was in eighth grade, she wanted to be in a musical play, Sound of Music. She didn't get in the local theater section where we were, so she went to the nearby Jewish Community Center in Skokie. After a couple trips there during rehearsal, I was told that it was my day the next day to bring cupcakes or some treat for the 24 children. As I started to walk out, she told me, lady at the desk said, make sure they're kosher cupcakes. In a bit of a quandary, I know a little bit about Judaism, but not all. I talked with her, and I said, well, where can I get them? She said, oh, any number of variety. I said, do you have any suggestions? She said, Kaufman's on Dempster. So I said, okay. Now, I could have gone. I'll guarantee you there are any number of places in Skokie that sell kosher cupcakes. And the kosher is, as I understand it, a process. My name is Sullivan. I'm not. My brother actually converted to Judaism, but I know very little about it. I'm sure there are any number of places I could buy kosher cupcakes in Skokie. I'm sure there are any number of people who, if I went around asking for kosher cupcakes, would tell me they know what kosher cupcakes are, and they would sell me cupcakes that they say are kosher. I could probably even buy cupcakes and have some police officer follow me back, and he could report to the lady at the Jewish Community Center that, yes, I interviewed the person that sold him the cupcakes, and they said they were kosher. But I went and bought cupcakes, and I brought one, I think, just literally to examine. There's no way, looking at a cupcake, that you can determine whether or not it's kosher. So what I did is I went back to the lady. I had a box of 424 cupcakes, and she looked at me with the obvious question in her mind, how do I know they're kosher? I said, here's the receipt from Kaufman's, and look on the side of the box. It says Kaufman's. Judge, that demonstrates almost every argument I have to make about the plea agreement and the underlying hearing below. Judge Dara and the government and the defendants in this case in plea agreements agreed to a standard. The standard would be the Edwards standard. In the plea agreement, in the colloquy between at least my defendant and Judge Dara and the government, Judge Dara said it would be determined whether or not the cocaine in this case was reduced by the crack method. Government wants to argue that we couldn't have agreed to that and it didn't mean that. It clearly did. It's a little bit like kosher. It's defined, but it's a process. The government experts below testified. They can't tell me whether that cupcake was made by a kosher method unless they were there to watch. The FBI agents who testified, then once we get past the plea agreement, the next question is, what is the foundation for the testimony of the witnesses? Mr. Perez, I think like any vendor in Skokie, if I walked up and asked for kosher cupcakes, he'd have sold me cupcakes. Whether they were kosher or not, who knows? He may have even tried to make kosher cupcakes once or twice. But how do we know that the cupcakes he sold for a couple of years, all of them on the corner were kosher? We go on. We have other people testify. My biggest push in the trial court below was with the witnesses. What is your foundation for saying it's kosher, for saying it's crack cocaine? Well, the agent would testify he had training. What was the nature of the training? The judge said, I know what crack cocaine is, Mr. Sullivan. We don't need to go into that. The witnesses, I think, need to provide and did not provide an adequate foundation below.
But
they use the word crack.
Nowadays, is any cocaine base being sold that isn't crack?
I don't know that, Judge. I'd have to do a study to do that.
It used to be free base.
Well, it used to be.
But I don't know that that's still sold.
Yeah, you may be entirely right, but I don't know. But what I can tell you is my estimation is if you go and buy crack, you go and buy cocaine base in the elite northern suburbs of the city of Chicago, they're probably not going to call it crack. And because they don't call it crack, does that mean it's not produced by the crack method? Similarly, the other side of the same discussion is, because they call it crack down in the poorer neighborhoods of Chicago, in the Hispanic neighborhoods where this case was involved, because that's the street term, the preferred street term, does that mean it was produced by that method? I don't know. Unless I pose the simple question to this court, and I think Your Honor is right. If you want to say that all cocaine base is now crack cocaine because we know of no other method, that kind of obviates my argument and the whole position you previously took in Edwards. But so long as there's some requirement that it be shown to be crack or reduced by some crack or a similar method, I think the witnesses need foundation when they testify that they called it crack in order to distinguish between them calling them something crack and it being
when
actual
you say
crack
the
cocaine.
Production process, how specific is that? Does it have to use sodium bicarbonate?
Judge, the recent rulings of this court certainly don't say that. And I would suggest, I have a very limited chemistry background, there are probably other similar substitutes you could put in instead of sodium bicarbonate. But at least the method is fairly simple. It's an aqueous reduction using a chemical that reduces a variety of the cocaine out into a hydroxide form. I assume there's a variety of other chemicals that could do that. But I think that still needs to be, as long as the definition is out there that crack is not all cocaine base, there still needs to be some foundation for the witness to say, I think it's done by a method that reduces it like the crack.
Did you produce scientific evidence to support that?
Judge, the government's two experts testified.
Well, did you have any experts?
We had an expert. The judge did not find him particularly credible, primarily because he wasn't regularly involved in the reduction of cocaine base or cocaine the cocaine salt into the cocaine base form. But we didn't go into the other methods. That was not one of the questions that either the government experts brought up or went into, or our expert brought up or went into. It was strictly whether or not this stuff was reduced by a sodium bicarbonate method. That's the only discussion that was really had during the hearing in our case. Judge, very briefly, I'd also like to just mention as to the quantity calculation. In my view, or in our view, as to defendant Gonzalez, the judge originally, Mr. Perez originally estimated saying once to twice a week. At the hearing, he testified he doubled that. He said 2 to 3 times a week he would deliver to my client. He was thoroughly impeached, had a variety of problems, and I think the district court erred by accepting the uncorroborated higher estimate. Thank you, Judge. I see my time's up.
Sullivan. Mr. Mejia? Mejia? Sorry.
I represent Fidel Hernandez, who was in the same indictment. His issues are entirely different. He was sentenced apart from the others. And essentially, four issues are raised having to do with guideline calculations. I'd like to first just discuss the facts as briefly as possible because they're so germane to the issue as to whether or not the court erred in using the defendant's statements obtained during the time of cooperation through counsel following his arrest with law enforcement officials, erred in violation of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure Rule 11, then in existence, and Rule of Evidence 410, in using his statement in which he admitted to additional cocaine quantities to increase his guideline score from then 30 to 34. When he was taken in by law enforcement officials, they were aware of some plus 50 grams in the area of 75 grams of crack cocaine to which he had been involved in the conspiracy. Following his assistance and cooperation, they learned of another 500 to a kilo and a half more, increasing his guideline score. It was my position at sentencing that under Rule 11, this should not have been used against him. It was not admissible in his trial, had he gone to trial. It's not admissible under the rules. It was a bargained-for statement, and the argument the prosecution made was, first, while there was no proffer letter, which I think the case law, Bridges and Cross I've cited, show that an actual proffer letter isn't needed. It's the agreement itself. And second of all, it is entirely incongruous to say that, well, we can use this at sentencing, even though it was not admissible at trial, and notwithstanding the fact that Rule 11 says such statements obtained during the course of plea discussions or negotiations are not admissible in any criminal proceeding. It was here a case where not only the defendant assisted and cooperated for the time that he did, he actually was pretty much made an informant, but in the time thereafter, he then left the state of Illinois. He was no longer under arrest. He was no longer facing criminal charges. He knew charges may be brought in the future, and it was because of this exiting Illinois for 2 years where he was brought back that the other issues came into view. First of all, he was given a two-point increase for obstruction of justice. It's the position of the defense, citing, I believe that it's the Alpert case out of the 11th Circuit, that one who is in the process of negotiating, one who is not under indictment, one who theoretically is facing criminal charges but not on bond and not under any restrictions of release, who leaves the state, is in the same position as a person analogized to those cases involving flight from arrest. Flight by just leaving the jurisdiction, but it isn't equal to obstruction of justice as the courts have analyzed that.
Why? I don't understand that.
Well, because one obstructs justice where one facing criminal prosecution or where one on bail or where one under some conditions or restrictions of court order exits the jurisdiction. This was a man who was brought in with a pending criminal complaint. He was told, as is common practice.
If he goes and hides, that's certainly obstructing justice. I don't understand.
Well, its
motive is to avoid being caught.
Correct. That's correct.
It's not obstruction of justice.
It's not obstruction of justice because the way they negotiated the agreement at that point was to dismiss the criminal complaint, to turn him to a confidential informant, to use his assistance and cooperation against other individuals, with no open-ended restriction or agreement as to what would happen in the future. He knew there, because of the extent and degree of your cooperation, we will determine at a future date what charges may be brought against you and what punishment you may have. And, you know, looking at the Alpert case of the 11th Circuit, it was nearly identical. And the court there said, you know, there is this thing about flight which doesn't in and of itself mean obstruction. One, because it, I suppose it's like one who says I'm not guilty can't be prosecuted for making a false statement. I mean, it's like an exculpatory no. In the same sense, one who is not on bond, not under indictment, one who is a cooperating informant, and one who doesn't have restrictions on himself and leaves, obviously then may unilaterally cancel that agreement of cooperation, but it's not obstruction. And I think the case supports that.
He lies to the police and says, well, really, the person you're looking for is in Madagascar. We'll go look there.
Well,
that's certainly obstruction. What's the difference between sending the police on a wild goose chase and hiding from them so that they have to, you know, spend more resources to find you?
Yeah, Your Honor is correct. Where one assumes a false identity, which he didn't do, where one gives misleading or false information to law enforcement authorities, which he didn't do, where one conceals himself.
There's a distinction between assuming a false identity and just hiding somewhere.
That's just the way they analyze them. I mean,
it doesn't make any sense.
Well, but they look at it respectfully, Your Honor, to say, wait a minute, did he leave the jurisdiction and assume a false identity for purposes of concealing himself? This man went to Florida and he worked at a religious commune under his name. He was brought in 2 years later. Obviously, he was indicted in the next year that followed with others, like 6 or 8 months later, and he was brought back and essentially resumed the position where he had been. I admit all I have done. I confess to my offense. I'll enter a plea of guilty. I will argue nothing contrary to the facts as they are. In fact, in our plea agreement, it was agreed with respect to the weapon matter, with respect to obstruction, with respect to his admissions, and with respect to the statements he had made. All of it's uncontested. In fact, we have a case before you where the facts essentially are uncontested. The question is whether or not his simply exiting Illinois when he did, unilaterally canceling this confidential informant position that he occupied, constituted obstruction. The court said it did. I believe that it doesn't fall within obstruction as the cases have described it, and Your Honor is right. Yes, where one impedes law enforcement, but what did he do to impede law enforcement other than he left Illinois? He didn't have, you know, and I don't mean to be redundant with it, but he didn't have restrictions upon him. He wasn't on bail. The case was dismissed. No pending criminal action. It came to roost at sentencing because obviously what happened here was they calculated a guideline score that basically, you know, put him at an astonishingly high range at 41. Seeing this, the court said on its own, Judge Dara said, well, all right, I think this overrepresents what his criminal culpability is. This would give a sentence of 30 years. I will give him 25 because I believe that the way it was all calculated simply would result in a sentence that is entirely too harsh with respect to all that's happened. Indeed, he was punished severely. He faced 10 to life. The sentence he received was 25 years. Based upon all of the arguments I've made, based upon his cooperation, his plea of guilty, his relinquishment of his rights for his cooperation, I even say I think the court could have still given him acceptance of responsibility. The judge believed he couldn't do that because of all of the facts, particularly with regard to his leaving the jurisdiction. Anyway, on his behalf, I'm asking a full review, and I'm asking that you reverse the sentence and send it back for reconsideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mejia. Mr. Smith?
May it please the court, and good morning. I'm Dylan Smith on behalf of the United States. While I can attest to the quality of the food at Kaufman's on Dempster Street, I don't think the analogy quite holds. Judge Kaney asked whether to be cracked there needs to be sodium bicarbonate, and of course the answer is no. This court has held that it's no, and in fact it cited Edwards and it's embrace of a flexible definition of what crack is, a street term, in support of that position. And Edwards, in fact, is not really a case concerned with defining what crack is, for the very reason that the district court had already found, if you will, that the substance involved was not kosher. In other words, the district court had made a factual finding in Edwards that what you had was a form of cocaine base that, to the district court's mind, was not crack. And so the only real issue in Edwards was do the enhanced penalties apply, the statutorily enhanced penalties apply for all forms of cocaine base, which is the term used in the statute, or as in the case of the guidelines, does it need to be the crack form of cocaine? And the court held, citing Booker, that both the guidelines and the statute, section 841A1, are concerned with the crack form of cocaine base. And obviously at the outset of Edwards, you have a reference to the definition of crack cocaine set forth in the guidelines, which talks about crack cocaine being a street term for a form of cocaine base that's usually prepared following a certain method. And when Edwards has been cited in subsequent cases by this court, it's that portion of the opinion that is seen as the definition that's embraced by Edwards. And in the wake of Edwards, defendants did try to argue, going to Judge Kaney's question again, that there wasn't sodium bicarbonate here. This can't pass muster under Edwards. That's been rejected. The position that Mr. Gonzalez seems to be taking here is even more restrictive because, in effect, you know, he's essentially saying unless you have direct evidence of someone witnessing, you know, someone cooking the crack cocaine, pouring the baking soda in there.
Well, is there any cocaine base being sold that is not crack?
The record is a little unclear on that. Judge Dara explored the same question, sort of musing aloud at the hearing. Generally speaking, it does seem, just looking at the reported cases, I've not seen an example of cocaine base that's not crack, other than the free base method from the 70s. I know, as I mentioned in Edwards, on the unique facts of that case, the district court didn't believe that the government had sustained its burden to show it was crack based on the appearance of the substance. But I'm not aware of any other form of cocaine base that's out there. Obviously, chemically, the right. paste that's generated from the cocoa plant is a cocaine base. But in terms of what's out on the street, this is outside the record. But I'm not aware of any. And just briefly on the question of the testimony concerning the quantity attributed to Mr. Gonzalez. Obviously, this is a question that's determined by the clear error standard on review, but the disparities in terms of the timing of this, I'll just refer the court to the record, because the district court certainly was entitled to rely on Richard Perez's testimony, who was the cooperator testifying on behalf of the government. He had initially provided a written statement where he indicated that he had dealt cookies, which was the term for crack cocaine, to Mr. Gonzalez 1 to 2 times per week. Didn't indicate the amount there. That written statement is in the appendix to Mr. Gonzalez's brief. On direct exam at the hearing that took place in January 2008, he testified that he sold them 2 to 3 8 balls per week, and then in a follow-up question said on a typical occasion, he testified that he provided 2 to 3 8 balls per week, the quantity, and then said when he would go to his house, he would sell him 1 or 2. So it's not at all inconsistent with the idea of 1 or 2 visits per week at which 1 to 2 8 balls were sold. Subsequently, on cross-examination, he was asked a leading question to the effect of, now you testified you sold an 8 ball 2 to 3 times per week, and it's possible he didn't catch the distinction there between the timing and the gross quantity, but clearly the district court was entitled to rely on this. It's not clear error. Turning
back to the first point, so powder cocaine you sniff, is that right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. It's not
you smoke.
Correct.
So does anybody sniff cocaine base?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I don't know that there's anything in the record.
Couldn't this issue be resolved once and for all by some? Couldn't the Justice Department do a study of the cocaine market and say, look, if it's chemically cocaine base, it's crack because there's no other. There's no other use of this stuff.
I think that could be helpful. I think
this issue, you know, this comes up in case after case.
Right, Your Honor. I think that's right. It does come up, and you know, and the testimony in this case really came close to that, because the testimony was that in terms of what the gang here was dealing, the Maniac Latin Disciples, the market was crack cocaine. There was no conflicting testimony suggesting that Mr. Gonzalez or Mr. Ayala were selling powder cocaine. You know, the testimony was that what they were talking about was crack cocaine. There was, you know, samples seized that had been involved in the conspiracy, some of which were found to contain sodium bicarbonate. So the evidence really was quite overwhelming, and I think if there were a record to the effect that, you know, there's no cocaine base out on the street other than crack cocaine, you know, that might be something this court could take judicial notice of in future cases.
Sure, judicial notice, but I mean, if there were studies that that an expert could refer to, it would help.
Right, and I agree with that, Your Honor, and I do think within the universe of that case, it came pretty close to having that situation here. Turning to the arguments made on behalf of Mr. Hernandez, and on his principal argument, which is under Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, it's Rule 11F now, which in turn incorporates Rule 410 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, he's got two big problems. One is the rules of evidence just clearly don't apply at sentencing. Rule 1101D3 of the Rules of Evidence say that. The case law and the commentary to the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure to Rule 11F make clear that even though there's no analog to Rule 1101 in the Rules of Criminal Procedure, there is no attempt through the Rules of Criminal Procedure to undo the regimes set up by the Federal Rules of Evidence there. The second real fundamental problem that Hernandez has on this claim is that Rule 410.4, which is the substantive provision here at issue, only applies to plea discussions that do not result in a plea of guilty or that result in a plea of guilty that's later withdrawn. So here we have a defendant who did plead guilty. The rule just does not come into play, even assuming you've got plea discussions there. On the obstruction enhancement, again, that is subject to clear error review. Just briefly to flesh out a little bit what was in the record there, Mr. Hernandez had been arrested in September of 2004, agreed to cooperate, agreed to stay in contact with law enforcement. After a few weeks, less than a month, his mother drives him to Florida. So right there, looking at the distinction the case law draws between panicked instinctive flight versus calculated evasion.
Well, I don't understand. What is that impulsive flight exception?
Your Honor, I believe that's intended to get at the situation where perhaps at the moment of arrest where law enforcement is converging on someone, perhaps the adrenaline kicks in and they run for a few blocks before giving in. You're not going to hit them with an obstruction charge there. But
you say run for a few blocks. What if they run out of the country?
I think there you would cross the line somewhere to obstruction.
I see. So the fact that it's impulsive is not the end of the analysis. It could be impulsive, but if he ends up, if he takes an impulsive flight to Beijing or something, he could be assessed for obstruction.
I think at some point the argument would be that the impulse has dissipated,
Where did this rule about a flea? Where did that come from?
You know, I'm not sure of the deep origins of that, but that
it's
does seem to be.
Not a guideline, is it?
No, I don't believe that language comes from the guidelines. I think that's
some judicial.
I think that's a judicial. A judicial
meaning of obstruction.
Yeah, I think that's a judicial creation. You know, but here, just in terms of the efforts law enforcement went to, they did. Mr. Hernandez was charged by complaint November 30th of 2004.
Didn't leave an address with them or anything?
Apparently did not leave a
so
forwarding.
They actually did have to. You mentioned the 2 years. Did it take them 2 years to find him, or did he just decide to come back after 2 years?
I think it took that time. The record is that it took that time to find him. I don't believe the record is that he voluntarily came back, Your Honor. But in terms of the efforts that were made, there were posters, flyers posted in his neighborhood by law enforcement. Agents did visit his mother, who, after all, knew here where he was, having driven him to Florida. But apparently, I think one, this isn't in the record. One can infer that there might have been the word would have gotten back to Mr. Hernandez that people were looking for him. He was even profiled apparently on Chicago's Most Wanted. So it does seem to to fit the bill here pretty squarely, whatever the outer limits of this enhancement are. To wrap up, the enhancement for possessing a dangerous weapon, that really doesn't seem to be pressed very strongly by Mr. Hernandez at this point, but that obviously, too, is subject to clear error review.
It's a little odd. So he gave his guns in order to get his girlfriend off or not arrested or something? Yeah.
At least the record was at least not arrested for the time being. There was no promise about what the future might hold.
Right.
And, you know, the key issue there, in part at least, is one of timing. This happened in June of 2004. His girlfriend is someone who ended up being charged along with him in the larger conspiracy and whom he admitted conspiring with in distributing drugs. So of course Mr. Hernandez remained at liberty for some time after that occasion. On
did she testify against him, or was he trying to prevent her from testifying or something by getting her out? Or
well, there's nothing in the record directly on that point, but I think it's not at all a stretch to say that when a co-conspirator in a drug conspiracy is arrested, there's some advantage to the other party of securing the release of that person as quickly as possible. And of course, the government having established that Mr. Hernandez did possess the weapons during the period of the charged conspiracy, it was Mr. Hernandez's burden to show in some way that it was clearly improbable that his possession of the gun was related to the offense. I'll just add to conclude that there was evidence of other instances in which Mr. Hernandez at least constructively possessed a weapon, in which another co-conspirator was arrested with a gun that he had obtained at Mr. Hernandez's
It
direction.
Was significant that she was part of the conspiracy.
Well, you know, that certainly was the fact here, and I don't know that the court...
The question is if she weren't part of the conspiracy.
That would be a different case, obviously. So unless there are other questions, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Smith. So, Mr. Sullivan, do you have anything further?
I will defer to Mr. Mejia.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mejia?
Referring to counsel's assessment of the problem with regard to the Rule 11 issue, is that the problem is that the consequences of a decision that such statements made after a promise of assessment of what the charges will be and what the punishment will be means that the person now is subject to increased punishment because of statements made during negotiations. I mean, that's an incredible problem, because we have a practice day in and day out of individuals who indeed do make statements in the course of negotiations, in civil and criminal proceedings. I mean, it just occurs. That's why there's a ban on it. And I don't think it's so difficult to say, wait a minute. Through his lawyer, he agrees to speak. Through his lawyer, he discusses increased quantities with other individuals, identifying other people, criminalizing other people, which leads to other prosecutions as an informant, and now we're going to use those against you. And
what
I just don't...
Mr. Smith's distinction between you have a plea agreement and you don't have a plea agreement.
Well, I think essentially what that means is those particular discussions don't lead to a plea at that time. That do not lead to a plea or a plea withdrawn. Ultimately, he said, well, because this was a plea agreement, they can be used. That's not the rule. The rule is statements made that are prompted by an exchange of promises, that is, I will cooperate with you if you'll promise to assess those in punishment and what I will be charged with, is the point of it. And that's why negotiations aren't used at trial, aren't used in further proceedings, aren't used at sentencing. Let me bring up something about the weapon. This was clear at the trial level. Mr. Hernandez was stopped. He was in the presence of a female. She wasn't a part of this conspiracy by anything that we know. The police at that time did what police do. We want firearms. If you give us a firearm, we'll let her go. He then calls somebody else who makes arrangements to deliver two firearms to the policeman so the young woman can be set free. There's a point to be made here. This is post-arrest. There's no crime being committed at that time. The gun wasn't...
She's not a member of the conspiracy. The government says she was.
Well, I don't know how they can. She is arrested with the defendant at a point in time during the course of the investigation, an occupant of a vehicle with him. He is the target. He is the one who possessed the narcotics. He's the one on his way to distribute them in Cicero, according to what they hear. He's the one who's later indicted for it. She's not. She is a person with him. The point of the point of
she
the
was not indicted as a part of this conspiracy?
I don't believe Janet Rosales was indicted. I mean, I...
Well, that's just contrary to what the government just said.
Well, I mean, I'll look to the indictment. I have no information. It certainly wasn't a part of what we talked about in terms of what this involved in the... Let's just say she was. Let's just say she was a part of the indictment. The fact is the police negotiate with him on the street there. We want firearms. You give them to us. We won't arrest her. What does that have to do with anything with regard to possession of a firearm in the course of a prosecutor defense? He's not possessing a firearm there. He's not possessing a firearm then. It's prompted by a police negotiation of we'll let her go if you give us guns. This is the Chicago Police Department investigative tool on the street to gather guns. Now he's punished for it by a two-point increase because he responds to a police agreement with them, give us a gun, we won't arrest this person in your presence. Finally, let me mention about, just to conclude, about whether or not the defendant obstructed justice again. Now, Your Honor said, when is the fine line between whether it's a spontaneous act or whether it's a sudden act of this or that? The courts and the commentaries talk to it. And essentially, where one takes off in spontaneous flight, they're not going to put obstruction. But they also talk about whether one is facing indictment, whether one is facing judicial process, whether one is under court restriction, whether one has made false and misleading statements, as you point out, which are crucial and important. This man was a truth teller. He is telling the police all they want to know. He's confessing to crimes they don't have. He is naming other conspirators. He is assisting and cooperating. And they made no agreement, okay, you're going to be doing this for a year, or you're going to be doing this for 6 months. It was open-ended. At a point, for whatever reasons, his safety or urgency required, he unilaterally quit being informant and went to Florida, lived under his name, and was brought back. I don't believe this is obstruction, not as I understand obstruction of justice.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mejia. And you were appointed also.
I was.
Well, we thank you and Mr. Sullivan very much for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your clients. Next.